Case number 21-1055, S. Jones versus City of Detroit, Michigan, et al. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. James for the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Bruner James for the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Jones. This is the second time that this matter has come before this court, and today's hearing focuses on Mr. Jones's claims under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act against the City of Detroit for its failure to accommodate his disability in providing post-arrest transportation, which caused him physical injuries. As this court may recall, Detroit police arrested Mr. Jones and eight other activists protesting residential water shutoffs in July of 2014. The officers lifted Mr. Jones while he was seated in his wheelchair and placed him into a prisoner transport van that did not have a wheelchair lift, did not have safety restraints for Mr. Jones or a lock for his wheelchair, nor did it have sufficient headroom for a person while seated in a wheelchair. Mr. Jones alleged in his complaint that the City of Detroit was vicariously liable under the ADA and the Rehab Act, and he also alleged that it was liable through its own policies for its violation, all for the denial of a reasonable accommodation of his disability.
Did the complaint also allege a deliberate indifference by the city?
The phrase deliberate indifference is not in the complaint itself. However, as we'll discuss throughout this argument, that's not the standard for liability under the ADA against municipalities in this circuit, nor in any circuit when the allegation is a failure to accommodate. The district court below dismissed these claims, erroneously holding that the U.S. Supreme Court's 1998 decision in Gebser v. Lago Independent School District establishes a total bar on vicarious liability.
So on this Gebser point, where do you break the link, right? I mean, we have pretty explicit language about incorporating remedies, procedures, and so forth. And I realize it's not, you know, Title II directly to Title IX. I got that, but you know, Judge Friedman had this Mariushka doll point, which I thought was a pretty nice way of putting it. What did he get wrong about that?
Well, it was a clever analysis on the part of Judge Cohn, but there are two primary reasons why the analysis just simply is improper. One is the legislative intent of the ADA and the Rehab Act versus Title IX, as well as the difference in liability standards under intentional discrimination under Title IX and a failure to accommodate claim under the ADA and Rehab Act, which doesn't require establishing discriminatory intent.
I just want you to hear where I'm coming from. I mean, even the ADA itself, I mean, Title I has a different regime, different remedies, but it incorporates a different enforcement regime. Title II is just very express about its enforcement regime. So it seems at the outset not to matter what types of liability there is. They just go different routes in which enforcement regime they're incorporating. So that has me puzzled why it makes a difference whether Title II accommodation is different from, say, run-of-the-mill discrimination as you would get in Title I of the ADA.
Well, let's dig a little bit deeper into the legislative and statutory construction and intent. Title IX is contractual in nature insofar as it applies to institutions that receive federal funding. Thus, the failure to comply with Title IX results in a loss of that funding. And the court in Gebser also noted that the enforcement regulations require notice to the appropriate person and an opportunity for voluntary compliance prior to withholding federal funds. So the Supreme Court in Gebser reasoned that Congress did not intend a stricter standard of liability for civil actions than that which was set forth in the funding enforcement mechanism.
So with respect to the ADA then, this is not a spending clause provision at all. It's an anti-discrimination provision under the 14th Amendment, correct?
Correct. Under Title II, there is no contractual nature, no funding mechanism. This is an affirmative duty imposed upon states and local governments to provide a reasonable accommodation.
And on the regs, are there regs that require notice to the institution for a Title II claim?
No, there does not. Moreover, all of the circuit courts throughout the country who have addressed this issue explicitly have decided that both the ADA and the Rehab Act are vicarious liability statutes. This circuit has not, let me modify that slightly. They are vicarious liability statutes when there is no requirement to establish discriminatory intent. And many circuits have decided that it's vicarious liability, even if there is a requirement to show discriminatory intent.
Excuse me, sorry. Did those circuits, though, come to grips with Gebser?
Some of them have analyzed Gebser and Lease directly. Lease is the 11th Circuit case that Judge Cohn relied on, which was a Rehab Act claim in 2012.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm mm-hmm. focused on the ones that you're invoking that support you. In other words, I got the point that there's a, we'll call it a circuit split, but it doesn't seem that the circuits that support you have engaged with Gebser. So that requires us either to say Gebser's irrelevant or those aren't very helpful precedents.
Well, to the extent that Lease relies on Gebser for its analysis, and circuit courts that have addressed this issue since Lease was decided, they've addressed Lease directly, and I believe some of them have addressed Gebser directly, but if not, when they have analyzed Lease, they are in turn analyzing the same logic and analysis of Gebser because it was so important to Lease. Now, Lease was decided back in 2012, and circuit courts have been consistently holding that these two statutes are vicarious liability statutes as recently as earlier this summer. There was a case that was decided, in fact, 2 days, I think, before our reply brief was due, that just explicitly noted, this is Phillips v. Prater in the Fifth Circuit, decided August 3rd, 2001. It says explicitly the ADA and Rehab Act are vicarious liability statutes. So this holding has been consistent long after Gebser, long after Lease, and explicitly analyzing Lease. Now, it's a district.
What do you make of the fact that Fifth and Ninth Circuits more recently have said that Title VI doesn't have vicarious liability, and Title VI is quite relevant to Title II of the ADA?
I'm not familiar with the cases to which you refer right off the top of my head.
Okay.
But to the extent that the ADA was amended in 2008, where we can read Congress's explicit intent that both of these statutes should be read and interpreted as broadly as possible to protect the rights.
Forgive me for not knowing this. Remind me what they did in 08, what language from the 08 amendment helps your side?
So the explicit amendments in 2008 were explicitly overruling isn't the right word, but disagreeing with a number of Supreme Court precedents that had limited the definition of a qualifying disability. So it's not directly on point as to the precise issue that's before this court. But what it does demonstrate to us is that the legislature repeatedly throughout the course of these amendments explicitly stated that the term disability should be interpreted broadly and that these statutes generally should be interpreted broadly in order to fully protect the rights of people with disabilities. So we know Congress's intent here.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from the other side. I think you're on mute, maybe.
I apologize.
No worries.
First of all, I would say that this is not even a case to look at vicariously liability. All of the officers in this case have been dismissed because, as this honorable court noted in the previous appeal, there was no clear established right to post-arrest transportation. So if the officers...
Doesn't that mean that the officers could have constitutionally violated Mr. Jones's right, but the right was not clearly established at the time?
That's correct. That there was no right that's clearly established as transportation. And in fact, the case law cited by the plaintiff's attorney, the courts indicate in Roll, R-O-L-E-L-L, they indicate they need not decide whether Title II applies in the context of arrest. And in Rosen, they said it stretched the definition to say that it applied in arrest. So for the city to be vicariously liable when the officers didn't even have established right that they understood as to what they had to do is not the right case to look at for vicarious liability. How could they be vicariously liable if the rights were not even known? But if we get past that, with regards to vicarious liability in the other circuits, the only time that appears, or at least the majority of the time that appears that a vicarious liability is even discussed is when there's intentional discrimination. Delano Pyle versus Victorio, which is cited by the plaintiff, is an intentional case. And even if you look at Duval versus County of Gibson, they actually address failure to accommodate in one discussion and then intentional discrimination in the other. And the only time the respondent superior comes up is with regards to the intentional discrimination. The plaintiff's attorney has already said they are not suggesting there is intentional discrimination in this case.
Why should that be the law that vicarious liability applies only in the case of intentional discrimination?
Because if it's intentional discrimination, it's something that the city could do, you know, that the city could be responsible for, something that they could be in control of. If it's just something where, like in this case, where the police officers arrive at the scene.
Why does that make a difference? I mean, vicarious liability, in part, that issue turns in part on knowledge of the city. And why would they know about an intentional, why would they know anything more about an intentional act versus a failure to accommodate act?
Because the city would have more knowledge of whether intentional acts are being committed by their employees rather than just simply misjudgments that wouldn't be something that they would have control over. A police officer going out into the streets and reacting to a scene is not something that a city can have control over.
Because but here, my understanding of the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sure. That the city had no policy.
Oh, that's wrong.
Transporting, let me just finish and then okay. You can tell me where I'm wrong. But the city did not have a policy of transporting wheelchair-bound arrestees in wheelchair-safe vans. And indeed, that the city did not even have such a van. That is my understanding of the facts. And so the city clearly would know that all officers who were transporting wheelchair people were transporting them unsafely, or else they would call EMS or they would call the rapid transit people who had wheelchair accessible vans. So now that I've finished my question, tell me where I'm wrong.
Sure, the city had a policy. Matter of fact, the plaintiff sets it forth in their motion for summary disposition. And we talked about it in our response. The city said, depending on the situation, because you don't know what the situation is, you had to either get a ambulance or a van or another accommodation. Now, did the city have a modified van at that particular time? No, but they did have a policy of accommodating people with wheelchairs in transportation. So it
and
was
so the policy. The policy, are you saying the policy allowed a person in a wheelchair to be put in a cargo van without any restraints?
One of the options was a van. With regards to specifically noting all the details, it does not. It leaves it up to the officer on the scene because every situation regarding the police is different. So they could have called an ambulance. They could have called other people that are listed in the code for accommodation. Now, this officer believed that the van was the best option in the circumstances and believed that it was safe. He's already been dismissed from the case. But the city did have a policy as to that the officer had these options and they were to assess the situation and choose from the options. Now, whether or not you believe the officer made the correct choice is really not no longer an issue. But certainly the case law is very clear that respondent superior only is applicable in intentional discrimination cases.
Did you raise respondeat superior in your motion for summary judgment?
We talked about it with regards to the officers. And then in
that's
the motion-
not with respect, that's not with respect to the city, who's the one who is potentially liable under the theory.
I disagree with that because it was our position that if the officers are not responsible for ADA violations, then the city could not be respondeat superior responsible for any violations because it comes their liability comes from the police officer's liability.
Yes, but our prior decision didn't say that the officers weren't liable. Our previous decision said that they were entitled to qualified immunity because the law was not clearly established.
And that prior opinion didn't establish the law at that time, just like the prior cases didn't establish the law. So if there is no law that they're required to give post-arrest accommodations, I mean, then the city cannot be responsible for the police officers not giving post-arrest accommodations. There is yet to be any law that says that the police officers have to give post-arrest or arrest accommodations. As a matter of fact, the cases specifically cite that they don't even think that ADA accommodations fit into the situation of arrest because it's not a service. But either way,
is that an issue you think we should decide in this case?
I don't think that's an issue that has been brought up for appeal. I think the Court of Appeals order was specifically, is there respondent superior in this case? And I think,
I'd be curious what your view is about the direct liability as opposed to vicarious liability for the city, whether that it was mentioned in the complaint in paragraph 50 in the amended complaint and elsewhere, and should that be allowed to go forward?
I do not believe that is a part of this appeal today because the order was very specific from the Court of Appeals that the appeal was limited to the issue of respondent superior. But if they were to look at that, there is no direct liability of the city. The city had a protocol and they at all times abided by the ADA. And not to mention, again, there's been no finding that the ADA even applies to a post-arrest transportation. Unless you have any further questions.
I have none.
I will concede the rest of my argument then.
All right, Ms. James.
Sure. Let me just run through a couple of points that were raised. One, the fact that the officers were dismissed and granted qualified immunity for Fourth Amendment claims simply has nothing to do with whether or not the city can be held liable under the ADA. You know, one, we're talking about liability under a specific body of law established in the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, not the Fourth Amendment. And even 1983 law is clear that qualified immunity doesn't apply to municipalities. So this argument simply has no bearing here. Now, with respect to the Gebzer analysis and establishing deliberate indifference, frankly, respectfully, defense counsel has it backwards. Lease makes it very clear that the reason that they're looking for deliberate indifference on the part of a decision maker at a who has full discretion over a key decision point is for the purpose of imputing discrimination to the city itself or to the municipality itself, not establishing whether or not they failed to make an accommodation. I would urge the court to look at the language in the case called Fortin. It's a district court case, but the analysis specifically addresses Gebzer and Lease and the so-called circuit split. And I would actually urge this court to consider that there is no true circuit split, as Lease itself does not create a bar to vicarious liability. The language explicitly declines to do so, but rather they were imposing a rule in order to determine whether or not intentional discrimination can be imputed to a local government. I would also note that Fortin, despite being a district court case, has been cited with approval by this court in 2019 in KC. Let me find the citation for you. KC v. Marshall County Board of Education, 762 Fed Appendix 226. That was decided in 2019. So this court has already looked at the analysis in Fortin, or looked at the case of Fortin, and found it persuasive and worth citing. So I would encourage this court to do so. The last thing I'd like to mention is that even if the court, again, wants to decline to address the issue of vicarious liability in ADA cases, there also are ample facts of deliberate indifference in the record. In addition to not having wheelchair accessible vehicles, the policy itself didn't require that people who use wheelchairs be transported in appropriate vehicles, but it did at least contemplate EMS as a possible means of transportation. However, none of these officers had any knowledge or memory of that policy. They had no recollection of receiving any training about arresting or transporting people with disabilities. None of the supervisors were even aware at the time that summoning EMS was an option. And finally, Commander Barron was clearly the person who had complete discretion over the key decision of how to transport Mr. Jones at the scene. This is precisely the type of situation contemplated by Lease v. Indian River County Hospital District, where such a decision could be imputed to the municipality itself. And I would be happy to answer any more questions.
I have none.
I think we're okay. Thanks to both of you for your helpful briefs and arguments and for accommodating this Zoom approach to oral argument. But it's not a bad idea on these must panel cases. So thank you very much. The case will be submitted and the clerk may adjourn court.